Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're doing something that I absolutely love.
Oh, yeah.
We're taking something that seems, you know, incredibly mundane, something you might walk past 100 times a day, and we are peeling back the layers to reveal a world of absolute chaos and complexity.
It's the best kind of deep dive. We're looking at the hidden life of materials.
Specifically, we're looking at steel. But not the steel you're probably thinking of.
Right.
We aren't talking about, like, the girders in a skyscraper or the panel of a car door. We're zooming in, way, way in, to look at a specific microstructure that's sort of the black sheep of the metallurgy family.
That's a very fair description.
Yeah.
Usually when we talk about steel microstructures, the spotlight is on the superstars, the famous ones.
Right. And the biggest superstar of them all is ordinary perlite. If you open a textbook on steel, perlite is chapter one, right?
Absolutely.
It's the standard against which everything else is measured. It's reliable, it's everywhere, and it has seen tremendous commercial success. It's the celebrity.
Exactly. Ordinary perlite is the celebrity. It behaves, it forms predictable layers, it does what you expect it to do.
But that's not us today.
No. Today, we are not looking at the celebrity. We're looking at its rebellious, slightly dysfunctional cousin, a structure that is chemically complex, physically difficult to form, and, frankly, a geometric shapeshifter. We are talking about alloy perlite.
Alloy perlite. It sounds like a superhero variant, or maybe a supervillain.
In a way, it is a bit of a villain to the manufacturers who have to deal with it, but scientifically,
it's amazing.
It is a marvel. The source material for this deep dive highlights a really fascinating contradiction. Despite being a masterpiece of atomic architecture, alloy perlite has, and I'm quoting here, yet to attract profitable application.
That is the hook right there. Why is this thing so cool, so complex, but so useless, or at least unused?
That's the question.
That's our mission today. We're going to unpack what happens when you take the standard ingredients of steel and swap them out for heavy hitters like chromium and molybdenum.
And we're going to see why that swap creates a massive headache for the atoms involved. It turns a simple process into a logistical nightmare.
Okay, let's unpack this. First things first. We need a definition.
Sure.
What exactly makes alloy perlite different from the ordinary stuff? Because to me, perlite is perlite.
To the naked eye, maybe. But under the microscope, and certainly at the atomic level, they're worlds apart.
So to understand the rebel, we have to understand the conformist first.
Exactly. Ordinary perlite is a mixture of two phases growing together. You have ferrite, which is basically pure soft iron, and a carbide called cementite.
Cementite, that's the hard stuff.
Right. Cementite is iron 3 carbon. It's a simple molecule. 3 iron atoms, 1 carbon atom. It's the cheese in the sandwich if ferrite is the bread.
Okay, simple enough, iron and carbon sandwich.
But in alloy perlite, we are dealing with a totally different beast. We're dealing with a substitutional solute rich carbide.
Whoa. That is a mouthful. Break that down for us.
It just means the carbide isn't just iron and carbon anymore. It's packed with other metal atoms.
Ah.
In the sources we have, these are referred to generally as M atoms. M stands for metal.
So we're swapping out the iron and the carbide for something else.
Exactly. And not just one or two atoms. These carbides are chemically dense. Instead of the simple Fe3C, you get these massive complex molecules like M23C6.
M23, that's 23 metal atoms.
23 metal atoms to 6 carbon atoms, or M7C3, or M6C. I mean, these are huge complex structures compared to the simple cementite.
Mm.
And the M is usually a heavy transition metal like chromium, molybdenum, or tungsten.
So ordinary perlite is like a basic ham and cheese sandwich. Alloy perlite is like a 7-layer artisanal feast with imported ingredients that are really heavy.
That is a great analogy. And that heaviness is exactly where the problem starts. It introduces what I like to call the heavy lifting problem of diffusion.
Diffusion is just atoms moving through the metal.
Yes. Right? But think about the difference in who is moving. To form ordinary perlite, you mostly just need carbon to move around. Carbon is a tiny atom. It's an interstitial solute. It fits in the little gaps between the big iron atoms. It zips through the iron lattice very quickly.
Like a motorcycle weaving through a traffic jam. It doesn't care if the cars are stopped. It just goes through the gaps.
Precisely. Fast and agile. But to form alloy perlite, you need those heavy metal atoms, the chromium, the molybdenum, to move to form those big M23C6 carbides.
And they're not tiny.
Not at all. They are substitutional salutes. They are roughly the same size as the Iron Atom.
So they aren't the motorcycle, they're the SUVs.
Exactly. They're the SUVs or maybe even the moving vans. They don't zip through the gaps. To move, they have to push their way through the lattice. They have to wait for a vacancy, an empty spot to open up and then hop into it. It is a slow, laborious process.
So carbon is a motorcycle. These metal atoms are like trying to move a grand piano through a crowded room where no one wants to move out of your way.
That is a perfect visualization. And this movement is called partitioning. The source emphasizes that in alloy perlite, this diffusion, this moving of the piano, has to happen on a scale comparable to the colony size.
Wait, colony size? That implies they have to travel a long way.
In atomic terms, it is a cross-country road trip. They can't just shuffle to the neighbor's house. They have to migrate relatively long distances to get to the right spot to build these complex carbides.
So you have these massive, slow atoms trying to travel long distances through a crowded dance floor. I imagine that takes a toll on the speed of the process.
It completely dictates the kinetics or the speed of the reaction. And this brings us to a really cool, slightly terrifying concept from the text, kinetic strength.
I saw that formula in the notes. It looked a bit intimidating. Walk us through it.
Let's break it down. The formula is phi equals times the exponential of minus 190,000 joules per mole over RT.
Okay, let's not get bogged down on the math, but what's the story that equation is telling us?
It's a story of a battle. A battle between time, which is T, and temperature, T. The source calls it the kinetic strength of the heat treatment.
So it's a score.
Basically, yeah, it's a score. If your heat treatment doesn't achieve high enough score, alloy perlite simply won't form. The atoms won't make the journey.
So you need enough time or enough heat to force those heavy pianos to move.
Exactly. And the source gives us a specific number from the data. The minimum kinetic strength required is approximately 5.9 times 10 to the minus 12 hours.
That number sounds incredibly tiny.
It is, but look at the exponential part of the equation. Because of that massive energy barrier, 190,000 joules per mole temperature is the deciding factor.
Okay.
If you look at figure 10.2 in the data, it plots the time required against temperature. There is a steep, unforgiving curve. It shows that if you try to do this heat treatment below 500 degrees Celsius, you hit a wall.
A wall.
Ideally, in steel processing, you often want to treat steel at lower temperatures to refine the grain or get specific mechanical properties. But with alloy perlite, if you go below 500 C, the atoms are moving so slowly that the time required to form the structure shoots up towards infinity.
Infinity.
Mm.
So it becomes practically impossible.
It becomes totally impractical. You'd be waiting years. The atoms are essentially frozen in traffic. That's the kinetics challenge. It's why this material is so tricky to manufacture compared to ordinary perlite, which forms happily at a wide range of temperatures.
So you're sitting there in the factory waiting for your steel to transform, and it's just not happening. Because the chromium is stuck in traffic.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's say we do have the heat. We crank it up above 500 degrees C. We give it enough time. We force this reaction to happen. What does this stuff actually look like? Because I'm looking at these images, figure 10.1 specifically, and ordinary is definitely not the word I would use.
It is quite dramatic. In the best case scenario, when everything is calm, alloy perlite tries to grow as spherical nodules. Think of little balls growing inside the metal, expanding outward.
That sounds somewhat orderly.
That's the Dr. Jekyll side of the material. But things can get aggressive very quickly. We see the Mr. Hyde side when the driving force gets high.
Driving force. That's the urge for the metal to transform.
Yes. This usually happens at lower temperatures, what we call large undercooling. The metal is desperate to change its structure from austenite to perlite.
But the atoms are slow.
But remember, the atoms are slow. So you have a high desire to change, but a low ability to move.
Frustration.
Atomic frustration. And because of this, the cooperative growth breaks down. In ordinary perlite, the ferrite and cementite grow forward together, holding hands. But here, the nice, smooth sphere starts to shoot out spikes.
Spikes? Like a sea urchin?
A bit, yes. Or sawteeth. The text describes a spiky morphology. They show an example of a chromium-rich steel, specifically Fe0.22C 10.6Cr. At 550C, just above that critical temperature limit, instead of nice round blobs, you get these jagged sawtooth shapes biting into the remaining metal.
It looks chaotic. It looks like an explosion.
It is chaotic. The ferrite and the carbide are supposed to be growing together. But when the driving force is too high, that cooperation diminishes.
Yeah.
One phase starts racing ahead of the other, and you get these jagged protrusions.
And this leads to a case of mistaken identity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
This is the part of the notes that felt like a detective story.
It does. This is a classic trap for metallurgists. When people look under the microscope and see these spikes, they often scream, bainite.
Bainite is another structure in steel, right?
Yes. Bainite is famous for being plate-like or needle-like. It's the sharp microstructure. Yeah. So when you see spikes in alloy perlite, it's easy to get confused.
So how do you tell them apart? What's the DNA test?
You have to look at how it formed. Real bainite forms through a shape change, a displacive transformation. It physically deforms the crystal lattice, like shearing a deck of cards. It snaps into place.
And alloy perlite.
It doesn't do that. Even though it's spiky, even though it looks aggressive, it's still growing by diffusion, by those atoms hopping into place one by one. There is no shear, no shape change.
Oh.
So if you look closely at the surface relief, you can see it's an imposter. It looks like bainite, but it's actually just a very aggressive, spiky perlite.
I love that. You can't just trust what it looks like. You have to know its history. It's the detective work side of science.
Exactly. You have to ask the atoms how they got there.
Now let's zoom in even further. We've looked at the shape of the colony, the spikes and nodules, but what is going on inside? If I could shrink myself down to the size of an atom and walk into one of these alloy perlite colonies, what would I see?
If you walked inside a colony, specifically one made with that massive M23C6 carbide we mentioned, you would realize you are standing in a giant interconnected web.
A web? I thought perlite was layers.
Yeah.
Like pages in a book.
Ordinary perlite is layers, but alloy perlite. Well, the source describes it as a bicrystal.
Bicrystal. Two crystals.
Yes. Despite looking like many different layers or stripes under a microscope, if you analyze it, the ferrite is all one single crystal. And the carbide, it's also one single crystal. They are two giant crystals interpenetrating each other in a complex 3D network.
That is wild. So the ferrite is like a sponge, and the carbide fills the holes in the sponge.
Well, essentially, yes. They're interconnected in 3D. If you dissolve the iron away with acid, you'd be left with this fragile, complex skeleton of carbide. It's a beautiful architecture.
But nothing is perfect. The notes mention a glitch in this architecture, a start-stop growth.
Right. Even though it forms this bicrystal, the growth process is not smooth. Figure 10.3 shows a transmission electron micrograph, which lets us see almost down to the atomic level, and it reveals a flaw in the system.
What kind of flaw?
As the perlite grows, sometimes the system hiccups. Small bits of carbide tiny precipitates form independently at the interface.
They're not part of the main skeleton.
No, they aren't part of the main cooperative growth skeleton.
So they're like little rebels breaking off, or debris on the road.
They are like roadblocks. When these little particles nucleate, they disrupt the main growth front. The source says it is as if the lamellar growth is suspended. The main layers have to stop, wait, navigate around these little particles, and then restart.
And I assume that messes up the look of the structure.
Completely. It makes the interlamellar spacing, the distance between the layers, highly irregular.
Right.
In ordinary perlite, you see these beautiful, perfect, even stripes, like a barcode. In alloy perlite, because of this start-stop behavior, the spacing is all over the place. Thick, thin, wavy. It's messy.
It's fascinating that on a microscopic level, there is this constant struggle. The atoms are trying to organize into this complex 3D bicrystal, but the physics of nucleation keeps throwing wrenches in the gears.
It's a very difficult construction project, and the workers keep taking unauthorized breaks.
Right. Now, we've been talking mostly about chromium, but there's another character in this story that changes the geometry even more drastically.
Ah, yes. Molybdenum.
The fibrous mystery. This was section 5 in our notes. So far, we've talked about layers lamellae. Even if they are messy, they are still sheets of carbide and ferrite.
Right. Sheets are the standard, but sheets are expensive.
Expensive, you mean energetically?
Yes. Nature is fundamentally lazy. It hates creating surface area because surface area costs energy. A flat sheet has a lot of surface area. Usually, the crystal structures of the two phases match up well enough that they can form a flat interface without too much trouble. They fit together.
Like Lego bricks clicking together?
Yes. To make a flat sheet or a wall, you need the Legos to click together in two directions, length and width. If they match, you get a sheet.
Okay, I'm with you.
But enter molybdenum carbide, Mo2C. The source states that Mo2C is a bad fit for the iron lattice. It creates a lot of strain.
The Legos don't click?
They click, but only in one direction. The source says they have good lattice matching in one specific direction, but poor matching in the others.
So if you can only click them together in a straight line, You can't build a wall. You can only build a tower.
Exactly. You build a line or a fiber.
That is incredible. Mm-hmm. So purely because of the shape of the atoms and how they stack, the entire structure changes from sheets to fibers.
Precisely. In molybdenum-rich alloys, the perlite often doesn't look like sheets at all. It looks fibrous or needle-like. Figure 10.6 shows these bundles of fibers. It's a totally different architecture, purely because the atoms don't fit together comfortably in a flat plane.
That is the beauty of materials science right there. Chemistry dictates geometry.
It does, and there's a side note there about stoichiometry.
That's the balance of ingredients,
right? Yes. If you get the mix exactly right, what they call a stoichiometric ternary alloy, where the amount of molybdenum is perfectly balanced to eat up all the carbon, this fibrous reaction can go to completion perfectly. You get beautiful bundles of fibers.
But if you mess up the recipe?
If you're off balance, other phases interfere. The reaction gets a messy. It's like baking a souffle. If your ratios are off, it collapses. But in this case, you get a mess of mixed microstructures.
Let's talk about how this whole messy process actually begins. Nucleation. How does an alloy perlite colony get its start? Does it just pop into existence?
It happens at the boundary, the interface between the old structure, the austenite, and the new one. The source describes these protrusions or cusps.
Is it a smooth line?
Rarely. It's often jagged. The text explains that carbon partitions out into the austenite. This slows down the ferric growth in certain spots.
That carbide.
Meanwhile, the carbide might race ahead. This creates these protrusions.
It's a race where one runner keeps tripping the other one.
That's a good way to put it. And there's a big debate in the thermodynamics. Who starts it? Who nucleates first? The ferret or the carbide?
What does the math say?
The calculations of free energy, that's delta G, suggest that ferret might actually be the first phase to nucleate. It's easier to form. But here's the catch. The free energy change for the alloy carbide is much greater than for ordinary cementite, meaning there is a huge thermodynamic incentive to form these exotic alloy carbides. The system wants to form them because it reaches a much lower energy state at the end. That's why, even though it's difficult and slow, the alloy perlite forms instead of the ordinary stuff. The energy payoff is bigger.
High risk, high reward.
In a thermodynamic sense, yes. Nature is willing to tolerate the slow traffic and the difficult diffusion because the final destination is so stable.
And the crystallography, the way these crystals align with the parent metal, is described as non-unique.
Non-unique is a polite scientific way of saying it's a mess.
I love scientific euphemism.
Because it nucleates against an austenite grain boundary, the orientation depends entirely on which grain it's talking to. It might align perfectly with the grain on the left and look like a total crystallographic mess relative to the grain on the right. It varies from colony to colony.
So let's zoom out. We've been deep in the weeds or the fibers and the spikes.
Yeah.
We have this structure, alloy perlite. Let's recap what we know. It's defined by heavy metal atoms, like chromium and molybdenum, moving slowly through the lattice.
Right. The heavy lifting problem.
It requires high temperatures over 500 C just to get those atoms to move at all.
Correct.
And it makes weird shapes, spikes, nodules, fibers because of bad fits, aggressive driving forces, and start-stop interruptions.
It is a struggle against the odds to form this structure.
And yet, as you mentioned at the start, it's not really used for much.
That is the lingering question. The source explicitly says that the tremendous success of ordinary perlite has overshadowed these varieties. They have yet to attract profitable application.
Which is wild to me. We have this material that is essentially a natural composite. It's a mix of iron and super hard alloy carbides woven together in 3D networks or fibrous bundles. You would think someone would want that.
You would think. It sounds like a high performance material, but I think it comes down to that kinetics challenge we talked about.
The 500 degree wall.
Exactly. Manufacturing is all about speed, consistency, and cost. If you have to hold a piece of steel at 600 degrees for 20 hours just to get the atoms to diffuse and form the structure, that's expensive. Ordinary perlite forms fast and easy. It's cheap.
So alloy perlite is the diva of the steel world. It might be brilliant, it might be beautiful, but it's too high maintenance to work with on a production line.
For now. And that is the key phrase, for now.
I like that optimism. So what does this all mean for the listener? Why should they care about the secret life of alloy perlite?
I think it's a powerful reminder that steel isn't a monolith. It's not just one thing. It's a playground of atomic architecture.
Mm.
By changing just a few atoms, swapping iron for molybdenum, and changing the temperature, you completely rewrite the internal rules. You go from sheets to fibers, from smooth to spiky.
It's like coding, but with atoms. You change a line of code swap fee for Mo, and the entire rendering of the program changes.
Precisely. And just because we haven't found a mass market use for this specific code yet doesn't mean it's useless.
And that leads me to my final thought. We live in a world obsessed with new materials. Every day you hear about carbon nanotubes, graphene, metamaterials. We're always looking for the next big thing.
We are always looking for the shiny new toy.
But here we have this complex, spiky, fibrous structure hiding inside steel material we've been using for thousands of years. It's a bicrystal. It's a nanocomposite. It's all the buzzwords we love.
It is hiding in plain sight.
Exactly. So here is the question for you to mull over. Is the reason alloy perlite hasn't found a profitable application simply because we're trying to use it like ordinary perlite? Maybe the spiky, difficult nature of this stuff is actually a feature, not a bug. Maybe we just haven't invented the problem that this specific solution solves yet.
That is a very provocative thought. Maybe the application isn't in structural beams, but in extreme wear resistance or thermal stability or something entirely new.
Something to think about next time you look at a bridge or a knife. There's a whole hidden world in there waiting for the right application. Thanks for diving in with us.
Always a pleasure.
See you on the next deep dive.